Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. My guest this week is Ian McGuinness. He's historian and senior lecturer at the University of Highlands and Islands in Scotland. In this chapter, Bran is learning to find his lordly voice and navigate the treacherous waters of remarriage, of deciding which knight should marry which widow and which lands go to whom. So Ian is the perfect person to help me cover this chapter. And then in my bird's eye view section, I read an email from a listener that confirms, yes indeed, confirms that you can indeed legally shoot a Scotsman with an arrow from the city wall of York. Sorry, Ian. All right, without further ado, here is Scottish historian Ian McGuinness. How's my favorite Scotsman?
Good, thank you. Yes, how are you?
Doing very well. We're dealing again with Bran, who's having to manage all of the doings of these lords and ladies and disputes over, not really disputes over land holdings, but everyone's kind of jockeying for position. Mm. When they start to smell, you know, an opportunity. And of course, Bran is, you know, just trying to keep up. And he's told to kind of keep his tongue. But he's learning to be a lord at court, I suppose.
Yeah. No, I think it was quite interesting to see this play out. Because, yeah, it's framed by the maester in terms of, you know, this is what you're expected to do. This is your chance to learn. This is what your brother would have done, you know, appearing when your father was making decisions. But, yeah, don't say anything and let us do the work, which is, yeah, it's listen and learn, but not learn from doing.
I noted in this chapter, and I wonder maybe you could help me, there's almost a primacy placed on eating together. Mm. And I wonder if sort of wining and dining is sort of a really important political affair in Northern politics.
I mean, I think that element of just basic hospitality, you know, that there is a recognition of that. I suppose it ties into notions of gift giving and the various associations with that, which are largely positive. So you welcome somebody in and you give them food. Also, you know, if they're waited upon, then you're recognizing their status and the standing and the fact that sharing element, that you're sharing what you have with them, again, is very much demonstrating that kind of largesse, which you would expect of a lord to his man. And that's the relationship that is going on here. Even though it's Bran, the child, he's representing Rob. So yes, it is effectively the lord and his retainer, and the retainer is being welcomed into the household and given, you know, meat and drink and being given that time. And I think, you know, in medieval society, lords and retainers, that relationship is a close one often, and there are expectations of that relationship. So obviously the lord expects loyalty, he expects support, usually military, but what the lord expects in return is protection, but he also expects to have a say, and he expects to be able to speak to his lord, to be heard, to ask things of his lord, and indeed to receive stuff in return. So it is a two-way relationship. And so these men are, as the maester points out, these men are coming with things that they want, and it's then how do you diplomatically deal with that, which of course is at the end of the day will be Rob's decisions and Rob's issues to deal with, but they're the ones that have to listen to them and then pass them on so Rob can make that judgment.
Yeah, I think if you boil down this relationship between the suzerain and the vassal, it really comes down to, like, you care for me, and I will join your army when you need it.
Yeah.
You know, so, something. Of course, this is a different period, and of course, there's more political complication to it. But the symbolism of you've got a place at my table.
Yeah.
I think is really important to just remind, or I guess reinforce, that relationship.
Yeah, but I think it was the other way too. I mean, and these laws are quite explicit about it, because these aren't all, you know, the top tier laws. You've got a steward there representing the family. Mm-hmm. You've got Lady Hornwood, because her husband's dead, as is her son. You've got the Umber uncles, because the rest of the family are away. These are almost like the second tier, but they are very explicit to say, you know, our families are off fighting for your brother. So we've done our part of the bargain. Our families are all fighting in your war. Now this is what we want in return, you know. So it's I think there's no misconception that it is a two-way street. It's not all about, you know, the lord gets that, you know, the retainers expect to get as well.
Yeah, I want to talk about Lady Hornwood, but let me first read my synopsis of this chapter. Winterfell is buzzing with lords and ladies and lads, all who all seek to advance their social standing and land holdings. Bran is asked to sit at the big stone seat and voice courtesies while Lewin and Roderick handle business. After exchanging barbs with the Walders, Bran hears of widows and ships and chivalric troops, but his heart is with the squires tilting at Quintain's. Hodor carries Bran to the Godswood, where Asha asks him about his wolf dreams. Later, he learns of Stannis' letter and hears the rumor that Joffrey is the son of the Kingslayer. That night, he dreams again of the Three-Eyed Crow and a golden man in the sky who pushes him into the air. Ian McInnes, I'm really interested in talking about Lady Hornwood. Do you mind if we just jump right into that?
No, it's great.
Her story is that she's newly widowed. And the reason why she's newly widowed is because her husband has died in service of Rob. And that's at the Green Fork. And then at the Whispering Woods, she loses her son. And so now she's without an heir. All right. This creates something of a power vacuum. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, I guess you could put it in a, you could say, like, the rest of these lords are like buzzards. They're circling the corpse of the poor Hornwood boy. A lot of the conversations that happen in this chapter are about what is to become of Lady Hornwood. And you've got several suggestions for suitors. She has her own say in the matter. You've got one guy who says, well, I could just let her adopt my son. So everyone's kind of got designs, it seems to me, not just on her, but on what she would add to the family. Does this have a smell of authenticity to it? What would someone in the position of Lady Hornwood, let's say she did lose her husband and son, you know, what would her plight have been, let's say, in medieval Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does ring true to a large extent. I think she's in a particularly difficult situation because yes, it's not just the loss of her husband. If she'd lost her husband but her son was still alive, then she might actually have greater power as a widow, but as the representative of the family line and making sure that things progress for her son. The loss of her son as well is pretty much a kind of killer blow in that regard, because then she's the only representative, and so whoever marries her will inherit those lands, well, or potentially. And that's, I think, the point that Lewin makes. You know, there are other claims in the lands, and anyone who might be able to marry her can lay claim to the lands through that marriage, but because succession has now been knackered by the death of the father and the son, it may also be that then extended members of the family would have potential claims to rights over those territories as well. So it could get very messy. And what Lewin and Sir Roderick are discussing is essentially what would be the best way to resolve this without managing to, you know, anger everybody else. And I don't think there is an easy solution to it. But I think that's the kind of decision making that would be going on. And, you know, kings will take advantage of those types of situations to marry women off. So in the mid to later 14th century, you've got the case of someone like the Countess of Ross, who succeeds to that earldom, and David II looks to marry her off to one of his favourites. He's making sure that one of his friends, one of his allies, is in this important position and in this important earldom. But that comes at the cost of antagonising the men of Ross themselves, who don't want this new guy coming in, who they have no connection to whatsoever. And that causes problems. Similarly, there's an issue over the succession, or the marriage, sorry, of the Countess of Fife, when her father dies, and who's going to have possession of her, who's going to be able to marry August Fife as the preeminent Scottish earldom. And there's an almighty wrangle, even before the Earl of Fife is dead, there's an almighty wrangle over who's going to be able to marry her, or who's going to have possession of the heiress. So I suppose it's not quite the same, because those are mostly cases of daughters who are inheriting from the fathers. Lady Hornwood is different again. But as I said, I think she's in an even more difficult position, because I presume that the lands are her husband's. So she's not even, you know, she doesn't have the rights to the lands herself. She's just, you know, the last representative. And while marries to her may well earn those lands for whoever marries her, again, there could be a competing claim from elsewhere. Even marrying her off may not resolve it, because other families may still lay claim to actually succeeding to them. So it's, yeah, that one's a bit of an almighty mess.
She has a say in her, I mean, Hornwood has a say in her own plight, though, right? In this case, she has said, yeah, not interested in remarrying unless it's to you, Sir Roderick.
Yeah.
In no uncertain terms. She makes an advance on Roderick, who's not that interested in the arrangement, right?
Well, I think he's more keenly aware of his own relative status in all this, and just thinks it's unlikely.
Sure, sure. I think she's basically thinking, like, yeah, I'm just not ready for this, and I'll do it if you want me to.
Yeah.
If the king commands it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And I think Lewin wants to honor that eventually, because what he says is, I think that this kid, Baron Tallwood, or Tallheart, is maybe our best option, because it would allow her to, you know, adopt a son and raise him as her heir, and not, and sort of also honor her wish not to remarry.
Yeah, so she can remain a widow, but she's acting to help raise the new heir, and then he would succeed to the lands. Yeah, I mean, I think that's neatest in terms of trying to please everybody. I'm just not so sure that she has as much agency there. Well, in a medieval context, I'm not sure she would have as much agency there.
Yeah, sure. Now, if it was Rob, like, let's say, what would be the most politically advantageous for Rob? He might choose to say, one of these guys, one of these Umber brothers, you know, I'm going to need to strengthen my relationship with you, because you guys are valuable in the war effort. So let's go ahead and effectively give the Umbers all of the Hornwood land by granting them a marriage.
Yeah.
So in other words, this is an asset. You know, the fact that she's available is an asset for Rob to make a political arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, it's an opportunity to reward those who have been loyal to you. It's an opportunity to reward those who have lost as a result of the war. You know, to balance the balance sheet somewhat. And it's an opportunity to reward those that have done particularly well, or done particularly well by you, in terms of the war that's taking place. No, I think Rob would absolutely see it as an opportunity, and I think Lady Hornwood is, you know, an asset in that regard. It's about the politics of the North, but I suppose it also re-emphasizes the fact that, you know, while Rob is able to call out his bannermen and the Allmark South under under him and always looking nice and rosy, there are still opportunities for dispute and disquiet within within the realm. And that can happen over relatively minor things, but can suddenly then break apart what might seem on the outside as being a very unified North.
Now, of course, I was just thinking, like, if you're in Rob's position and you've just agreed to a marriage arrangement with a Frey girl for political reasons, right? Mm-hmm. You might think, well, that's what marriage, you know, man, I just had to get betrothed to this Frey girl. Everyone else is going to have to do the same, right? I think that there's something about that to me feels like, if you have been in an arranged marriage and you are king, of course you're going to expect your retainers to, you know, do the same if it is their duty to do that, right?
Yeah, and I think, although of course Rob doesn't in the end, but I think Lady Hornwood recognizes that herself. You know, that line of, you know, if the king orders me to do it, I'll do it. I think that's a recognition of her position and her status within that society. I mean, obviously she'd prefer things otherwise, but yes, I think she recognizes the reality of things. And yeah, I think Rob is absolutely good to treat it that way. That yes, this is a way to solve another problem.
It doesn't really ever get to this point, but you could imagine something happening this like this for Catelyn. I think that, or Catelyn or whatever. I do think that Rob would eventually be forced to decide, you know, whether or not to marry off his mother to one of these suitors, because that might be a political arrangement that might, you know, create an alliance.
It could, yes. Although I suppose there's less perhaps that comes with a marriage to Catelyn, but just because of the way the succession has gone. So obviously her husband has died, but he has left sons who are there to succeed him. So there's no, I mean,
there's no land to be had.
Well, in a medieval context, she would have dower lands. She would have lands that would be assigned to her from her to live off of as part of the marriage. So there might still be some territory that would come with a marriage to her. But there's certainly no access to the succession or anything. I suppose what you get is the potential of close access to the crown. I mean, if we treat Rob as a king, then you have access to the king. You're part of that extended royal family, which absolutely gives you enhanced status. And that would certainly change things. But I don't know if there's a desperate need to marry her off necessarily. I think she equally could just be a widow. And I think because of the nature of things, she would effectively be the queen mother and would live off her son, really.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So, I just got an email the other day from a listener who was asking about Tywin. Like, basically, her question was, why did Tywin never remarry?
Hmm.
And I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. Hmm. Like, surely Tywin is Mr. Political, you know, Mr. you know, I don't think that he would like, oh, I don't want to live in a loveless marriage. I think he'd be quite happy to make an arrangement if he thought it would advance his standing,
yeah,
and make a necessary alliance. But I'm just curious what your take on that might be.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean one of possible reasons might be just that you know, that he did actually, and it's not necessarily something you would associate with Tywin, but that he might actually have loved his wife, and thus not really considered that. Although I suppose I was thinking of a comparison with someone like Edward I of England, but even he remarries despite his very obvious devotion to his first wife.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can think of any examples analogous to this, where you've got a powerful lord who's basically, his children are in line for the you know, his grandson is king, basically.
Yeah.
Although that's disputed, but and he just chooses, yeah, I don't want to remarry. I don't think that, I'm too old to do this.
Mm. Maybe. What? I wonder if it is just age, or if he's invested so much in Jamie that you know, that he doesn't necessarily, yeah, see a need for anything further. You know, Jamie is the heir. He is the, or up to a point, he's the heir, he's the chosen one. And then, of course, Jamie decides that he wants to join the
Kingsguard. Yeah.
The Kingsguard, which, of course, changes everything. And that, I think that does come as a shock to Tywin. I don't think he sees that coming, because he's mm-hmm. constantly kind of complaining about it afterwards. And I think that does unsettle things. I mean, maybe as well just the experience of his kids, who are all just appalling. maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, sure. Now, of course, then you got the example of Walder Frey, who's like...
Oh, well, yeah, he's the opposite.
He's going to continue to, you know, sire children until they're too many, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a curious thing. Like, if he thinks Jaime... Well, I guess maybe he just never wants to give up on Jaime. But even then, it's like, you know, Jaime's at war. And, yeah, you know, you might not get him back. And, of course, your other son is a disappointment,
yeah,
whether that's earned or not. I think it's an odd decision not to at least to try again for Tywin.
Yeah, I think it would be unusual. I think that most lords would seek to remarry. Although, of course, I mean, there are issues of second marriages, because if you have children from the first marriage and children from the second marriage, then there is the obvious possibility of dispute then breaking out as to who has precedence. I mean, you do get examples where kings and lords effectively then alter the succession, so it's only the children of the second marriage who succeed, or it's the children of the second marriage who have primacy. And of course, that does cause all manner of issue with, funnily enough, the elder children. You know, so, I mean, maybe Tywin thinks that he has enough problems with the kids he's got that to then introduce further examples into the mix wouldn't exactly be healthy either. Yeah, no, it's never straightforward in those situations. But again, the medieval example, I think, would normally be that such men would remarry. Because, yes, as you say, you never know the nature of war and society. You never know if
yeah, I think Roderick calls that out in this chapter. Yeah, he basically says, like, you don't think you're going to be Lord of Winterfell, Bran, but the morrow is not promised.
Yeah.
A couple battles could go wrong, and you don't know who's going to be ruling the North.
Yeah.
Wyman Manderly is too fat to sit a horse.
Yeah, it's a nice.
Is this a big problem? Is this a big problem in the Middle Ages?
Well, I mean, you have the example of someone like Henry VIII, I suppose, at the end of things. There was a to do in the UK in recent weeks because it was suggested that Henry VIII should be classed as being disabled in his later years, and the right wing press went a bit nuts about that. But yeah, I mean, he's in a position where he's injured, isn't he? So he's then unable to be as mobile, and then kind of eats himself into the state he becomes. But yeah, he would be a nice comparison with that. And yes, these kind of things can happen, either through excess or just lack of mobility. You had the example of the French king, the earlier medieval French king. Louis the Fat. So such things could happen.
I think Taft had on the American side, Taft had that same problem.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. There was, famous stories about this poor guy. So, yeah, no, that's interesting. So you think that there's maybe a little nod or a wink here to Henry VIII?
Possibly, yes. I think it certainly, well, that was the first example that came to mind when I heard it.
So Bran hears about this troop called the Wild Hares, and they're all in their teens, really, and they're keen to go to war, and they've called themselves the Wild Hares, and they tie rabbit pelts to their lances, and they're sort of marauding around and singing songs about future chivalric heroism or something like that. Mm. And this really attracts Bran. Bran thinks, that's the life for me. he kind of longs to. He has a different view of these folks than Roderick does. Roderick has no use for boys playing at war. But this is exactly what Bran wants to do. He wants a childhood. That it's kind of been stolen from him. Mm. And what that looks like to him is to, to joust at dummies and whatnot.
Yeah. I saw that when I was reading that. I thought that there was rather more, he was rather more alike to Sansa then at that point, just because he's obviously been influenced as well by the chivalric tales, which is Sansa's kind of constant in those early years. And then she starts to discover that reality is very much not like the romances she's been reading or she's been hearing. But Bran is almost the same. He has that very positive outlook on knightly things, and as do these young guys. But it's that kind of that knightly youth, isn't it? These guys are raised from a young age to be trained in the art of war, to be trained in how to be a knight, how to ride. How to ride as part of a group, how to handle arms and to fight, and when you're raised in that context, when you're surrounded by that milieu, and you're trained to do that, then of course what you want then is the opportunity to test yourself. You want to show to your fellows your bravery and your ability, and when war is actually being fought, there is then that potential for frustration that you're not part of it, you're not there. And that can have negative effects because you end up in the situation, and that's obviously what Sir Roderick's kind of worried about.
Lincoln had this problem with his sons.
Really?
Some of his sons died tragically young, and then both he and Mary Todd were grieving the loss of those sons and were very reluctant to send their other sons to war, during the Civil War. Mm. Edward in particular had this notion that if he did not fight, it would have affected his lifelong legacy. He'd be known as the guy who was a coward or the guy whose father was the president and didn't allow him to show his wartime bravery. Mm. his view was that the entire generation, the entire post-war generation, would be defined by what they did during the Civil War. And he knew that his own life would be measured as such.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was reminded of those in Britain, you know, the ones who were too young to take part in the First World War, and so felt that they'd missed out. I mean, despite everything that we know now about the First World War, but who then went off to fight in like the Spanish Civil War because it was the first, their first opportunity to take part in a European conflict, because they felt they'd missed out. And yeah, I think again that there is that element, and it does lead to negative things at times. You know, young knights involved in war, and particularly in battles and things, that they're all sometimes written about as being too keen to be at the enemy, that they're too keen to demonstrate their skill, their prowess, their bravery. It's not, and so you end up with them doing stupid things, or they ride off out of formation and things because of their over enthusiasm, and that has to be kept in check. There has to be a decent amount of discipline. But even the best commanders struggle at times. I was talking to my fourth years last week about the Battle of Crecy. In the Hundred Years' War in 1346, and Philip VI of France has a serious problem corralling his young knights into doing what they're told, and the French end up fighting that battle in part because there's a section of the French knighthood who are so desperate to be at the English that they ignore orders and stumble into fighting a battle that the French aren't actually prepared to fight.
So yeah, so they're not showing the necessary caution, or they're not, I guess, just not following orders is a problem, right?
Yeah, and I think it's that youthful enthusiasm, but also just naivety, I suppose, and again abandoning the kind of greater good for their own personal gain. And I think that's the type of thing that Roderick's kind of frowning on is that they don't know what they're doing. They have these idealistic notions of what it is to fight, what it is to be part of a knightly group, but as you said, that they're playing at it, and if they actually were in the thick of it, it would be a very different experience.
Right. Now with Brand, now okay, so the North kind of has a problem in this way because you can't send all of your knights down south. And one of the reasons you can't do this is because of the Dreadfort. And we hear for the very first time that Roose Bolton has a bastard who up until a couple years ago wasn't even living at the Dreadfort, but he seems to have amassed a small army at the Dreadfort. And Lady Hornwood sends him a note saying, what are your intentions? And so there's some question about there's a historical problem between, the Boltons and the Starks. And so you can't send everyone down south because what if one of the houses rebels up north? And you've got this example with, Ramsay Snow, who is acting in very strange ways up north. And you might have to deal with someone like that.
Absolutely, and I think it is that case of when the lord's away, or when the king's away, that then yes, all manner of things might happen when their back's turned. And yes, as you said, especially if the lords and the troops have gone with them, then yes, what's left behind is difficult, and that's that situation that Lewin and Roderick find themselves in, because they're the ones that are effectively in charge. Bran is there as that representative of the Starks. But it's them that are doing the politicking, essentially, and then passing everything on to Rob. But they're the ones that are having to keep the ship afloat. And I think that is the first mention of Ramsay, isn't it? That mention of him,
I think it
is foreshadowing, isn't it, in terms of what the problems that we're going to face.
Go ahead, finish. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, but I mean that kind of problem is absolutely one that would have happened again in a medieval context, that as soon as there are lands potentially available on your doorstep, any self-achieving lord will want to extend their influence into them if there's a chance of doing so.
So not only do we hear of the Bolton bastard for the first time, but we hear the name Reek for the first time in this chapter. Yes. This, you know, Ramsay Snow seems to have this. He's got a man in his service who doesn't bathe, and you kind of see, like, eventually this is what's going to happen with Theon.
Mm.
And he'll just sort of rename Theon the name of this first guy. Mm. I had forgotten that name Reek was first given to some other guy.
No, and it's quite innocuous as well, isn't it? Again, it is very much that foregrounding of what's to come. But at the point at which it's discussed here, it's quite inconsequential because, you know, you're getting so many names chucked at you of all these various individuals
yeah.
and families. It's just another one of them at this point.
In other introductions in this chapter, we meet Wyman Manderly in the flesh for the first time. And we meet someone named Poxy Tim. poor Tim. Lady Hornwood, of course. The name Reek, we hear that for the first time. Lady Donella, Baron Tallwood, Moors, and Hother Umber. We don't. Bran wonders why Hother Tumber is named Horsebane, but he, you know, he's not told why that is the case.
No.
Leobald, Tallheart, and we hear the word hedge wizard for the first time.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I think hedge witch we might have met before, but now we've met hedge wizard.
Hmm.
And this is a kind of a nod to this tradition of, you know, someone who's sort of out in the wilderness, dabbling with the supernatural, hmm. probably using, you know, herbal remedies and whatnot. And in general, I think that these people were viewed with suspicion by almost everyone.
Hmm.
Is there now, of course, we were talking about Lincoln earlier, you know, Mary Todd goes to a spiritualist at one point because she wants to, you know, have a seance to talk to her dead son.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any similar stories like that. Nobility going to these, I don't know, wilderness folk to use magic for some, you know, conjuring or something like that.
I'm kind of struggling to think of an example, to be honest. I mean, I suppose that such things would be kind of frowned upon, wouldn't they? And certainly as
so
as,
you're saying that this is really an American problem.
Well, no, but it's not necessarily. Well, I was going to say it's not necessarily a medieval problem. It is, but I suppose it's not necessarily seen as a problem. Uh-huh. Necessarily, it'll become one in the early modern period. I suppose I was just assuming it wouldn't necessarily be something that nobles would be dabbling in. It's the type of thing that's more often associated with those further mm-hmm. down the social scale.
Now there is this story in ancient Israel where the king goes to this witch in a place called Endor, not necessarily the moon of Endor, but the region of Endor, and conjures up the soul of a dead prophet.
Wow.
So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of history for people in the wilderness that are in, I guess you would say, sort of in Celtic terms, in a thin space, who are able to, you know, do something that seems like it's a little bit beyond natural medicine, things like that.
Yeah, I suppose it's, once you're into Christian times, it's another thing that's kind of co-opted by the church, isn't it? You have yeah. your very religious hermits instead who are the kind of wild men out in the middle of nowhere.
That's a good call.
They're being supremely pious in so doing. They're not in any way dodgy.
Yeah, they've retreated from society to sort of live in a more sacred way.
Yeah, yeah.
But functioning in much the same way. I'm thinking in terms of like this wouldn't necessarily be a in the same category, but the Anchorites were thought to be holy people, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I need to explain this, but there was a period where someone would choose to be walled in adjacent to like a chapel or a church or, you know, something like this. And they would just live inside of a small cramped space, kind of like a hermitage, but almost choosing to like live in a prison of their own making because there was some sort of ascetic holiness that was attached to this.
Yeah.
People would bring them food and then they'd pass out their excrement and then some people would go to them for advice because, of course, they must be really holy.
Yeah.
They're living inside of the wall of a church.
Yeah, it's that kind of extreme asceticism element of medieval Catholicism, isn't it?
I think
the church has problems with that at times as well, doesn't it? Because it also then leads to various examples growing up of people who are either a bit too near the borderline for the church's liking or who become too mm-hmm. popular. And the church doesn't like that either because mm-hmm. you don't necessarily want one holy person dominating or that is a kind of go-to person for people because that in itself can be dangerous in the long term.
Yeah, yeah, the long-term tension between the priest and the prophet, you know.
Yeah.
You know, one person has the job to sort of defend the institution, the other one wants to burn the whole institution down.
Yes, and that dangerous line between orthodoxy and not is a very difficult one. I mean, even someone like St. Francis struggles at times. The church has a hard time dealing with Francis for half his life, so...
Now, there are various ways that are described in these books on Brand dealing with his paralysis.
Mm.
And we've got a couple of these. Like, for instance, we've got this, you know, this saddle that Tyrion designed, and he's able in this chapter to ride using that saddle. We also see the image of him sitting in a basket. And being strapped to Hordor's back, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, later in the show, he's got a full-on, you know, wheelchair, which I'm not sure has a precedent. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the methods that would be used for, you know, nobility in Brand's circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of... The saddle, I think, would be practical, yes. You know, in terms of having something that kind of straps you in. I think the, you know, being carried about by Hodor is an opportunity to introduce us to Hodor. And that's part of that narrative that will tie mm-hmm. the two together over the longer term. I think most laws and things would have been carried around in a litter. And I think that would be the natural way to, if you were disabled in any way, that would be the way that would be done. And we, you know,
yeah,
do
if you
have
don't have a 7-foot simple-minded stable boy hanging around,
well, no,
maybe
but,
a litter's better option.
Well, yeah, and beyond that, just being carried around in a basket on his back just seems a bit, you know, unbecoming, doesn't it? Whereas,
well, and it's a problem too because he's, you know, Hodor every now and again smells bread,
yes,
and runs through the castle, and Bran gets conked on the head.
it's not particularly practical though. I think you would have, you know, you have examples like Robert the Bruce when he's ill rather than disabled necessarily, but also someone like Baldwin the Fourth of Jerusalem who has leprosy, and during his periods of illness, they would be carried around in litters when they were active. Although they could still ride a horse as well, but being kept in the saddle, I think, would have been difficult. But so having something like that would keep them in the saddle, I think, is quite practical.
Now, would the litter be carried by, you know, men like you'd see like with Egyptian litters, or would it be like on wheels, or would it be you know, between horses? How would that have been done?
I was assuming. Well, I suppose you could have it, you know, on in terms of a cart, so it would be wheeled or a form like that to make it
sure.
more mobile. But yeah, the alternative is that it would be carried by men. But yeah, that would be quite the effort. I suppose it's the practicalities of it, isn't it? The kind of Egyptian comparison is more something for status, isn't it? It's demonstrating the...
I think one, so, yeah.
Yeah, rather than the practicalities. So yes, perhaps something more cart-based would be. If it was just to get around, and I suppose that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Was there anything else about this chapter that you noted that you thought was interesting?
Yeah, I think the discussion of Bran as well, just in terms of, again... we've touched on the young lords and their ideas of chivalry, but I thought it was interesting to see Bran kind of thinking about those things, whether it was, you know, he'd like to be jousting in the yard, or whether, you know, he would like to be at war as well. That bit where he perks up listening to the possibility of building warships.
Yeah.
And, and he thinks of himself, of, you know, in quite practical terms of, you know, he might be a cripple, but actually, you know, he could, you know, sit on a warship and help command things. That would work quite well for him because it's a stable platform.
That's right.
It wouldn't matter that he was crippled. So yeah, that I thought was quite interesting. He himself was seeing a role for himself, or a potential role for himself, because a lot of it is quite, you know, his brand being understandably depressed about his situation, and not knowing that he won't be able to do these things. And that was just quite interesting, because the counter is always that, you know, he sees that pity in others, or that revulsion in others, whether that's actually there or not, whether that's in his own head. But on the other side of it, you know, he is still potentially seeing a role for himself, which I think is, you know, is quite positive.
Well, you do get this this line in this particular chapter where Bran, he can't help himself. He really wants to see the boys tilt. And so he goes to the yard knowing that people are going to stare at him. You know, he's in the basket, he's on Hodor's back, and he's almost used to it. He's like, I'm just going to have to live through these stares, because if I don't, I'll never see anything.
Yeah.
So he just decides he's going to tolerate the stares. And of course, I think, you know, these Walder boys know that they can't really make fun of Bran. I think that would be sort of a, maybe a little bit too much.
Yes.
You don't make fun of a prince, but what you can do is you can make fun of the simple-minded boy who's carrying the prince. Mm. And I think that almost, in some ways, I think Hodor is something of a proxy for them making fun of Bran.
I think that's why Lewin gets particularly angry, because I think he knows exactly what the Freys are doing.
Yes.
But he also, you know, understands that Bran just can't lose it at the Freys either. That he has to show some control and what have you. So yeah, but the Freys rather behaving as you would expect the Freys to behave, I think.
Yeah. And then I noted at the end of the chapter that, you know, when he hears of Stannis's letter, when he hears that there's been an accusation that Joffrey's true father is Jaime, this jogs something for Bran, even if he doesn't quite have it in his conscious life. He does have a dream of a golden man in the sky pushing him into the air. And in fact, I think we have a repeat of the line, "The things I do for love," at the end of this chapter.
Yeah. His repressed memory.
Yeah, that's right. Notable differences in this chapter. I noted that, a lot of this chapter is not in the show at all, but I did note that there was this scene in the show where Hodor is bathing in the Godswood. And Hodor comes out, you know, he comes out naked, and Asha notices Hodor's manhood and comments. Whereas in this chapter, it's Bran noticing Asha bathing in the Godswood.
Yeah.
And maybe there was a conscious decision to make that change in the show.
Yeah. Considering the various things said about Game of Thrones, I was going to say an unusual change, but it's interesting they've decided to make that change. I think as well that you've got that scene where one of the Northern Lords is standing in front of Bran, and Lewin, it's just Lewin is there as the supporting role, complaining about the fact that he's got no help to help him repair his castle, because all of his men are off fighting for Rob.
Gods forbid it rains. Why, I might as well sleep beneath a waterfall.
Maintenance of a holdfast generally falls to the lord of that holdfast.
Generally, yes, but I've sent all the young men off to fight Rob Stark's war.
King Rob. It is not his war. He didn't choose it.
Maybe not, my lord. But he called in his banners and took the men.
Joffrey killed my father, your liege lord. Do you remember your vows, sir?
Of course I remember.
We can spare four masons for a week, my lord. Will that be sufficient to repair your walls?
I believe it will.
We didn't want him here all day, did we?
Yeah, that is kind of like an homage to this chapter. Yeah. At least it's a little bit of a... It's a reduction of the feeling that you get from this chapter.
Yeah. Well, I think Bran was a bit more active in the TV show. You know, he actually speaks his mind and reminds the Lord that, you know, that it's his king, and that's what he's supposed to do. So I thought that was giving Bran a bit more agency than the books gave him.
Yeah, that's probably right. And it's probably a good idea. I mean, even if it's not necessarily, because Bran does speak up, even if it's just a matter of courtesy. He does decide to speak up in this chapter in a moment where they weren't expecting him to sort of rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Notable departures. A lot of coming and going between the lords in this chapter. I won't name all of the lords that came and went.
Winterfell
Winterfell really does feel like a hub of activity in this chapter.
I think it also just reflects the complexity of these territories, because we're used to, you know, hearing talk of the North, and obviously Rob is there with his army that's representative of it. But it's only when you see all these individual families with all their different representatives and all their competing, you know, demands and desires, and it really does give you a much clearer insight into what lordship and indeed kingship over that territory actually was like, or you know, is supposed to be like. That it's not straightforward. It's not some homogenous, unified entity. It is a mass of competing claims and all the rest of it that the lords of such have to steer a path through. And obviously Ned was able to do that before, but now you're into this situation where there's a new young lord in place. Not only that, he's now just gone off and gone to war, and everything is up in the air. It's a time of,
well,
it's a deeply unsettled time.
And just to put a button on our conversation about Lady Hornwood, I think that the fact that the king is now one of us, that there's something about, like, okay, if Lady Hornwood's situation needs to be arranged from some southern lord that we've never met, then maybe there's less of a gravitational pull to Winterfell. But because the king is now in the north, you know, it's Rob as king, it's almost empowered some of these other lords to kind of view their station differently. You know, maybe they can advance more than they thought that they could before if Rob is king rather than Robert.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the Northerners are always a bit of a funny lot, aren't they? So, I mean, they probably look at Ned as being a kind of quasi king anyway. I think they probably they have a much closer relationship to Ned than they would have to Robert. So I suppose in that extent, things maybe haven't changed as much. But no, you're absolutely right. I think you know, that change in status of Rob and of the Starks does then have the potential for a knock-on effect on his lords, and it may well actually, yes, increase the competition between them, and again, especially with a new lord, because all those relationships that existed between the lords, between the lords and his retainers, so between Ned and his retainers, that's now changed because there's a new lord in place who is now a king
and a younger lord, right?
Absolutely. So he may well look to younger men himself, and actually those older representatives of those families need to now make new relationships with Rob. So that's all been thrown up in the air as well. So yeah, it is a very unsettled time potentially. And we're kind of seeing that playing out back home while everybody else is elsewhere.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
The feeling in the Stark family is the same as like the Game of Thrones message boards. Like, they got Rickon, and
John's like, who?
Yeah, oh, John's.
Oh, Rickon.
He's the one that can't walk. No. That's Bran.
Rickon's uh-huh. the one that likes the walnuts.
Not ringing a bell. No, he's the other brother. Other brother of who? Of me. Was there another bastard? No, he's the youngest Stark. No,
not ringing a bell.
You almost have that moment when Arya's getting smacked around about how many brothers she has. It was that she forgot Rickon.
That's right. That's right. She lies. She lies about the number of brothers, and it was just an honest mistake. She just forgot Rickon.
Yeah, everyone else is like, no. You have another one. I don't think so. Smacks her again. No, I don't. The walnut kid. Mm-mm. No, I'm pretty sure he's a Greyjoy.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to read an email that I got from Rodri. Rodri responds to a conversation I was having with Arthur, and I was relaying to Arthur something that I learned on a tour in York. Using a bow, you could shoot a Scotsman with an arrow from the wall of York, and this would be perfectly legal. And of course, I doubted myself as soon as I said it out loud, thinking, that sounds foolish. Anyway, I got this email from Rodri, confirming that it is true. He says, hi, Anthony. Hope you're well. Reading a chapter from Game of Thrones Clash of Kings before listening to your podcast is always the highlight of my week. I particularly enjoyed the most recent episode. It is always fun when Arthur is on, and what a fantastic chapter. I agree with you on all points, Rodri. Rodri continues, you're right about the Scottish law in York. As a Welshman, we are taught in school about the law making it legal to shoot a Welsh person with a longbow in the English town of Chester after midnight. There are so many silly laws here which have never been repealed. I particularly like the one that says if a dead whale is found on the British coast, its head is automatically becomes property of the king, and the tail becomes property of the queen. I'm looking forward to when Cocoons of Horror returns too. Thank you, Rodri, for that email. I absolutely appreciate it.
And I ought to mention that if you are a Cocoons of Horror fan, my other podcast, Steve and I will be covering Severance sometime soon. So do a search for that. If you want to send me an email, book@baldmove.com. And that is all for this week.